It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another BritFlix podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is filmmaker Rhys Evanashen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Max out of 10 on pronouncing your surname.
Absolutely. Yep, I love it.
Thank you very much. I'm glad I got it right. We're here to talk about three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. But first, Let's talk about you as a filmmaker. You work with a good friend of mine and a friend of the show, Avi Feddergreen. And you're what, head of development, is it? Is
that your head of development? That's right.
Head of development at what company?
At Feddergreen Entertainment.
Brilliant. So do you want to give us a brief picture as to what Feddergreen Entertainment are up to right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this year specifically, we just completed production back in April on a feature film, which was a passion project of Avi's.
Yeah.
Called Home Free. And it's a pretty big, deviation from what we usually do, because we do a lot of genre fare. So it was our first time kind of dipping in and doing a much larger, broader drama. And it was an interesting experience because it wasn't something that I was necessarily involved with. It had been a project that had been in development for about 8 years prior.
Okay.
And then finally, it just came to fruition that we were able to get it made. And I was brought in just this year in January to take over as the screenwriter. And I had to completely rewrite the script.
Oh my word.
Before we started filming. So the start date was set, and I had to start writing the script knowing that we had to start shooting in March.
No pressure then, Rhys. No pressure.
No pressure whatsoever. It was a little bit like trying to build a train while you're on the tracks.
Wowza. Wowza.
Heading towards the destination. So I'm curious. It was a great experience. I wouldn't trade it for anything because I've never had anything like that.
Yeah.
Where I could just focus on being the writer on set, getting to work alongside so close with Avi, who's a good friend of mine, and that cast and the wonderful producers and team we had. So yeah, I'm excited to see how that turned out. That was sort of our big venture. And right now we're just on the lookout for other feature films, other properties. Yeah, it's pretty exciting. It'll be a year that I've been head of development as of this August. So,
brilliant. Now, you first came to my attention as the writer-director of For the Sake of the Vicious, yeah?
Yes, correct. Yep.
And that played at Fright Fest, which is where I saw it.
Amazing.
I loved the film very much, and I wrote nice words about it, which you may or may not have read. And one of the things that impressed me most was how much you got out of what was essentially a one location. But before we get into that, do you want, for the benefit of those that don't know the film,
Sure. Do
you want to give a brief synopsis to what For the Sake of the Vicious is about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's about a nurse who just finished working a double shift. It's Halloween night. She gets home. She's getting ready to get settled in to go pick up her kid to get her night started. And she finds a stranger in her kitchen with another person, a hostage, completely tied up in the kitchen with her. And she has no idea why they're there, no information whatsoever. And then it just unfolds from there. Why has this guy got this other guy hostage? What's the scenario behind this? For the first half of the movie, you almost think you're watching a procedural kind of courtroom drama set in this house where they're trying to deal with this conflict. And she's monkey in the middle, essentially playing the jury. And then at the halfway point, it does a 180 on you and it turns into a movie that you didn't even expect it to become. It becomes this intensely violent home invasion action horror thriller, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm just checking over my notes now, what I wrote. And in my final paragraph, I summarize by saying, for the sake of the vision, it dazzles with intensity. It never takes its proverbial foot off the audience's throat.
Yeah.
Was how I, and like you say, that isn't where you think you start, but certainly it's where you finish. Now, using a one location and using a real location instead of a studio,
yes.
From a filmmaker point of view, what do you remember being like a crucial challenge to overcome in terms of that kind of constraint, but also that kind of opportunity?
Well, I mean, it was in a way, yes, in a way, no. Like, we knew we were right. So it was written with my partner in the film. It was Gabriel Carrere who co-directed it with me. It was his story originally.
Yeah.
And he had just brought me on to write it at first.
Okay.
I actually had no interest in doing any more directing. I had kind of reached a, I had made a movie prior to this that was like a sci-fi B movie opus that I was very proud of.
Right.
And I wrote and directed it. And it came out in 2017, and Stuart, it tanked, like royally tanked. The reviews were awful. It didn't do very well. And it just kind of came and went. And I put so much hope and faith into it. I thought it was going to be the thing. And it just wasn't. And it really hurt me. And it was just one of those like, well, I did it and I got it.
You're only human.
Yeah. So when Gabe came to me with For the Sake of Vicious, I was like, I'll just write it for you. I want nothing to do with it. And then all of a sudden I was co-directing it. I was on set and away we were going. And it kickstarted a whole new course direction for me, which I've been on ever since. So I'm very grateful that I stuck around and did it. But back to your question, I mean, the house itself, we wrote it for the house originally because the script was so specific in its stage direction.
Yeah.
For the longest time, we had fully intended on building the whole house as a set because it was written for a bungalow, just a one-level house.
And that would be a normal approach for this type of film,
yeah,
wouldn't it?
Exactly. And we were so close, even when we were in pre-production. We had the production designer attached. I had the space. I had the studio space. We were getting ready to build. And then at the last minute, for his own reasons, the production designer backed out of the production. And that's fine. It was a low-budget film. I get it. They had to take something else, no harm, no foul. But we found ourselves in a situation where it's like, well, then we have to find a house. Like, there's just no other way. And I managed to have a connection through my dad, of all people, who had helped out a local business who had now like a flourishing contracting company. And he called them on a whim and I got them on the phone. And I said, we start in a month. This is the scenario. I said, I need a house that I can destroy. And just to my pure luck, they had just purchased a piece of property that they were going to tear down in 2 months and build two different houses.
No.
And they said, you can have it for a very low fee and you can do whatever you want to the house. And I said, no, wait a minute. I said, I need to know that when you say that, you mean that. Because I'm like, we are going to destroy this house. Like I said, there's gunshot, fights, everything. We're going to destroy this place. They said, no, you have our word. So
yeah, because I was going to say, there's, once you invite a film crew into your house,
yes.
Even when it's not a violent revenge movie.
Yeah, oh, it's a disaster no matter what you do. Yeah, even on a drama, as we just had in April. So they gave us the keys to the house and we were off to the races. And I'm like, it's incredible that it came together that fast. It was a little tricky at first because the house was obviously a completely different layout from everything that we had been rehearsing and practicing. So we really had to kind of put our heads together in those last couple of weeks before we shot and sort of rethink the action.
Yeah, because thinking about it, a bungalow is a single story building, whereas you clearly go upstairs and downstairs in the official version.
Yeah, and it's great because it actually gave us way more suspense and way more room to play with. It was the thing that doesn't come across in the movie, I don't think, is the house looks massive to me in the movie. When you're in the house, like, it is so incredibly small. We didn't have a big, like, it wasn't a big budget film. We had one trailer outside, but everybody had to share the house. So pretty much whenever the camera's filming, so just picture 14 or 15 people like jammed into a room.
Well, I'm going to say the bit that sticks in the memory and which is no mistake in the constraints of size you're working with is the sequence in the bathroom.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
So do you want to talk us through kind of how you prep for something like that, and how long does that sequence take to even get into the camera?
100%. I mean, the bathroom was our set piece in the script. It was always the favorite part of anybody who read it.
Yeah.
When we got to the house, the actual bathroom was incredibly small, very, very small, like barely walking room. It was just toilet, sink, shower.
Yeah.
But what was next to it was a spare bedroom. So we looked at the spare bedroom and we said, we're going to make one set. Let's build this set. So we ripped up the carpet. We went to a secondhand store. We bought the giant clawfoot tub because I wanted that specifically by the window for the action. We got a toilet. We got a sink. We installed it. We put it in. We painted the floor. Got the camera department to put in all the lights. And we shot it in one very long 20-hour day, which was awful. We had talked. We had prepped. The stunt team went in that morning. They walked through the entire fight with us. They got the cast in there. We rehearsed the fight for probably 6 or 7 hours. And then we just shot it. Boom, 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 boom. As intense as it is to watch, it was almost that intense filming it.
Oh, right.
Because it was just myself and the two camera operators and the cast in the room.
Mm-hmm.
I was behind the one camera operator A, and I was moving him around to get the shots I wanted, while camera B was doing the same. So the three of us were moving in this weird motion, and the sound recordist just set up mics in the ceiling, so they're out of reach.
Yeah.
But it was intense to film. It was like when you watch it in the movie, we were all jammed in there. It felt like we were all part of the fight. So I was pleased that it came together as well, because sometimes when you shoot these things, you know, you see it on set and you go, oh, this is going to be great. And then you watch it in the edit and you go, oh, my God, this is awful. But luckily, it turned out as intense and as sweaty and as vicious as it really was on the day. So
indeed. And then so that in that sense, though, what was the challenges of all that footage you'd got in turning it into what we see on the film?
There were no challenges. It was great because I had shot action before. So the trick to me for shooting action is you do it in segmented chunks.
Okay.
So you just shoot the parts you want to get. So rather than doing like one long master of shooting an entire 3-minute long fight scene, we break it down into, I think it was 10 sections. So we just go, okay, section one, let's shoot it. We practice section one, we get it perfect, you shoot it, great. Section one is done. Section two is done. And you just move on down the line. So when I get to my editing bay, it's already broken down in those sections. And you just have... All I did was shoot the shots that we needed.
So in a way, you're kind of using the sort of engine of the transition because you've broken it down. It sort of jumps to the next action because of the nature of how you've shot it.
Exactly.
So the idea of continuity doesn't matter as much because it's about the lurching around, isn't it?
Exactly.
Okay, that makes perfect sense, yeah. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much. But as an editor, the trick to it too is like, I know what I need in the edit.
Okay.
So I just shot what we needed. So when it got into the edit, it was actually, honestly, that whole film was one of the easiest films I've ever edited before. It came together incredible. I think I did it in less than a month. And that first version we showed, our rough cut, is not much different than the one that's released.
Was there any sort of new story development that came out of the edit? Was anything new discovered out of it that you needed to move around?
Yeah, I mean, we went and reshot a couple quick little things to add in, but for the most part, I mean, it pretty much was what it was. I mean, because of the nature of how small the production was, unfortunately, we had to cut a lot of stuff as we were going.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the movie, rightfully so, I've seen critics point out, it's got some plot holes, and I'm like, I fully acknowledge that. I'm like, because we had no other choice.
Yeah.
We had to chop stuff as we were going, and we kind of did our best to piece it together as we shot it. So I think it's the best possible version of that movie, given the circumstances that we had making it.
In a way, though, it's cousins are films like Assault on Precinct 13 and things like that, aren't they?
Yeah.
Where it's about the culmination of everything. It's not necessarily about how immaculately plotted it might be or not be. We kind of go with the energy.
Well, yeah. And the whole idea, too, for me was that you're just supposed to be dropped into the story with the main character.
Yeah.
And she has no idea what's going on.
Mm.
And that was the experience that we wanted from the whole beginning. It's like, we just wanted you to experience this as she was.
Mm.
You wouldn't know what was going on. You wouldn't know. In fact, I think we give the audience even too much information. I'm like, I wanted it to be completely unexplained. Like,
just... do you remember in that saying then? Do you remember what was the kind of kernel of the idea for Gabriel's original story that led to the film we see today?
It was that idea of. It was the hostage situation. That's where the kernel of the idea was.
Right.
And then I think I brought in the sort of home invasion thriller and the kind of crime procedural aspect to it.
Got you. So, yeah. Brilliant. Well, look, I was a big fan of that film. Still am a big fan of that film. Congratulations on it. And I'm happy I got the chance to speak to you about it. But now we're going to move on to three films that have impacted everything in adult life. Without further ado, and in the order that you gave me them in, the first film on your list is written and directed by James Cameron. It is 1984's The Terminator. Do you want to talk us through how you come across this film, where you see it, who you see it with, et cetera, et cetera?
Absolutely. So first off, my name is Reese, and I was named after Kyle Reese in The Terminator.
Really?
Yes.
You're off to a flyer already. You're off to a flyer already with that one.
Yeah. So my mom and dad, neither one... will give each other, I don't know, who they both say it was their idea. So I'm not sure whose idea it was at the end. So The Terminator has been there since the day I was born. I was born in 86. So it was 2 years after it came out.
Okay.
And it was introduced to me just on the very nature of like, you are named after this character. And you have to remember, and I know you do, this was a time when it was socially acceptable to show kids a movie like The Terminator, you know? And especially if you'll remember, The Terminator 2 specifically, Judgment Day, was almost marketed towards kids. You know, they had toy lines and everything.
Toy comics. Companies didn't seem to see the line between what was an R-rated film and what was a kid's toy, did they?
Exactly. So I had watched both of those films at an incredibly young age. My uncle... had specifically bought me the VHS double hitter, like two collector of Terminator 1 and Terminator 2.
Mm.
Now, admittedly, you know, when I was young, and I think this is fair to say, you know, Terminator 2 was always the one I went to because, you know, it's the spectacle, it's the action movie, it's the big one. But Terminator, the first one, especially as the years have gone by, has been the one that resonates with me the most. Not just because of the obvious connection to the name. More and more as I get older, what an expertly crafted film that is. And, you know, as a screenwriter, and I'm sure you'd agree, I think the one thing that gets overshadowed about or not talked about enough is how ruthlessly efficient James Cameron's screenplay for The Terminator is.
Oh, without a doubt.
I mean, like, it's... I mean, we don't have enough time to get into it, but, I mean, even if you want to focus on the bare bones of... You know, he was the master at delivering exposition. There's a good, 30, 40 minutes of that film where, as the audience, if you had no idea watching it for the first time, you don't know that Arnold Schwarzenegger is a robot. You have no idea.
Mm.
And it isn't until the techno-war sequence when Kyle shoots him a bunch of times and then he sits back up and he's chasing them in the alley and you see the red vision going, you're like, what the hell is this? And then through the course of a car chase, that's not only a car chase, but it's a shootout. And then a holdout in the middle of a parking lot. And then a chase with the police. Michael Biehn's character gives us all this exposition that in any other circumstance would be incredibly boring to listen to. But it is so thrilling because it's through a car chase. And they're getting shot at and they're getting chased. And he's dumping all this information on you. And you're so connected to Sarah Connor as a character because you're that character watching the film. You're seeing it through their eyes that you're going, yeah, okay, shit, I'd go along with this. And he does all the beats that I think you would go along with as well, like the misquestioning of it. You know, she asks all the right questions that you would in that situation. And he gives all the perfect answers that as a writer, it's a great throwaway because he doesn't have all the answers. So he doesn't have to give you all the answers. Like, I love when he's getting interrogated by the cops. And they're trying to ask him about the time machine. And he goes, I don't know. I didn't build the fucking thing. And I'm like, as a writer, I'm like, that's a great throwaway line because I would have no, I wouldn't know how to explain the stupid thing either. So.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, because one of the key things the film does is two things is it lets us imagine a dystopian future we've never seen.
Yes.
And it has to get that across or else it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And it's got time travel. So it's like, there's a double whammy going on there that's tough for any screenwriter to sort of bring to the table without too much talking.
Yes, 100%. And I think probably the biggest thing I take away from it is like inspiration moving forward on other projects, or just the thing that I connect to the most is going back to the idea of Sarah Connor, which is this, and you know, it's kind of the fundamental rule for most great films. It's an ordinary character that's been thrust into extraordinary situations, you know?
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Like, I love that perspective. We were just talking about it with the For the Sake of Vicious, where you have a character who is so removed from the scenario you're about to throw them in. There's just something that's so much easier to connect to as an audience member when you're watching a film like that. You know, it's hard sometimes when you go in and the character, you know, your lead character knows everything already, or they've been through this situation and you're playing catch up. Whereas Sarah Connor's character, I'm like, there we go.
Go on, finish your thought. Sarah Connor's character, what?
Well, you're along for the ride with her. You're learning all the information with her. You're getting the dazzle, the spectacle, everything, the wow factor. I think it's ruthlessly efficient screenwriting, and it's impressive that he did that back then before he became what he is now. You know?
So. Yeah, because James Cameron's responsible for two of the greatest sequels, isn't he? You know, T2 and Aliens. But
right, and then yeah. And I think this is a whole other conversation, but I'm like, Way of the Water too just proves that. I'm like, he's still great at writing sequels. So,
but I was going to say was that the thing with Alien and Terminator as first films is that they have that ability to give us an everyday character that's going to get thrown into something that we can put ourselves in. When you get to the second ones, you know, Sarah Connor is this ripped,
that's right,
military precision machine now that is fighting a dystopian future that she's trying to avoid the world getting into. Whereas the first one, it's, Mom, what do we do now?
yeah, 100%. So it's, anyway, Terminator.
Good man. Great story. Thanks for sharing that. So moving 2 years on to the year you were born, Day of the Dead, written and directed by George Romero. Do you want to, so what age are you then when this is brought to the table?
I think I saw Day of the Dead when I was 7 years old.
Okay.
This is back in the day of the mom and pop video stores, the independently run video stores.
Okay. You
know, where you could just walk in and freely browse any section. And, you know, I knew nothing about zombies, I don't think, at that age. I had no frame of reference for it. And for some reason, that original box art cover sitting on the shelf, you know, it had a yellow background with the zombies, but Bub was the most prominent character on the front.
Indeed is.
And I remember the tagline was like, first he brought us night, then it was dawn, and now Day of the Dead. And there was just something about that box art that I found so incredibly intriguing that I rented it at the age of 7. They let me rent it. You know, I don't even think they knew what it was. And I remember sitting down and watching that for the first time. It was at my mother's boyfriend's house. She had been divorced at this point.
Yeah.
And she had dropped me off there. I don't know why I was staying there. It doesn't matter. But I remember I had McDonald's in front of me. And I sat down to watch this film that I had no frame of reference for. And it starts off with the hands coming through the wall. And you're like, okay, that's interesting. And then it has this opening scene in Florida. They land. He's calling out, hello. You're seeing all this, like, you know, the world's in ruins. You're going, what the hell's going on? And then it cuts to that shot of the ground. And the music starts picking up. And you just see a silhouette of the shadow moving. And then it cuts to this shot looking up. And it's back against the sun. And there's this fucking zombie missing its lower half, its tongue hanging out, blood dripping. And then it looks up and the title goes, Day of the Dead. Let me tell you, Stuart, at 7 years old, having never experienced anything like that, that's the one thing in my life. I'm like, that moment changed my life forever. Forever. I was obsessed with special makeup effects from that point on. I wanted to know everything about Tom Savini, everything about George Romero, everything about that film. Like, that movie to me was a groundbreaking moment in my life and still continues to be. I mean, my love of zombie movies is insane. I love zombie films. My first film ever was a zombie film. But Day of the Dead has always resonated, not only, and I love the original three, Night, Dawn, and I know Dawn is usually everybody's favorite, and I like them all equally pretty much, but Day of the Dead is the crowning achievement for me. I think it's...
Well, I was going to say...
I mean, technically...
Yeah, I was going to say, technically, it kind of delivered on the gore that the world was ready to see, and it really went to town on it. Plus, as well,
yes.
It's the first one that feels like a genuine sequel. You could maybe plot a timeline from where the end of Dawn of the Dead goes to shit, and then picking up the thread with a new bunch of people, because the Dawn of the Dead sort of tackles that idea of there's a zombie invasion or a zombie takeover, whereas Night of the Living Dead is ambiguous as to the origins. You know,
that's right. Yeah,
it's just you just have to accept that the dead have come to life.
Yeah, and the other thing too, especially again as I get older, what I really appreciate is that it's this really dark and brooding, essentially Shakespearean drama in a cave. You know, it's got these epic monologues, and I know people like to kind of heard a lot of people sort of trash the acting in the film as being too over the top, blah blah blah. I think it works perfectly for the kind of film that he makes, because I always thought George Romero was very theatrical with his films, and I think that one suits his dialogue the best. Because if you actually look at the words that are being said in that film, I think it's some incredibly intelligent writing. Like, just some of the breakdowns of, you know, even when Sarah's talking to John and they're outside the trailer and he's just talking about, what's the point of all this? Why are we doing this? You know, we're trying to chase this thing that doesn't exist. You know, we should just enjoy what we have for what it is. And I've always loved that, because I'm like, that's just a perfect explanation for everything we have in life. You know, you're chasing this problem instead of just dealing with, well, it is what it is. Let's just accept it and move on. There's something about that that's always latched on to me. I think it's a great character study. And I love that I like that each film is so drastically different from the other two.
Yeah.
Like, Night is this very classic gothic horror film. Dawn is a comic book. And Day is this very brooding, dark.
I mean, in a way, and I've not thought about this till this conversation, Day is hugely influential on the original 28 Days Later, because...
Big time.
Because
Big
of time. The idea of what happens when the military try and take over in a free country like America, and obviously in 28 Days in a country like... Oh, there we go again.
This is fun.
There's our 5 minutes. It flies by, doesn't it? It flies by. But I mean, just to add, I'm a bit older than you, and I saw this as a 10, 12 year old when it came out, and it was one we watched a lot from the video shops. Right. And then it wasn't until watching it, like being a screenwriter, that I realized what a brilliant exercise it was in a contained horror film, because.
Absolutely.
I always thought of it as being a big film, you know, and I think that's that little trick of, like, out in Florida, helicopter coming in, going under, and you really don't leave the basement after that. And that's kind of, and obviously Night of the Living Dead is the exemplar of, you know, everybody with no budget has tried to try and emulate Night of the Living Dead. And obviously Dawn of the Dead has a shopping mall, which was just a beautiful set piece, but it's a huge playground. Whereas the underground bunker is a, yeah, it's like, we build these things to keep us safe, but actually, you know, what's the point if you're just locked underground forever? There's no, it's not living, is it? And
no.
That was a beautiful part of Day of the Dead.
No, and it also, I think it laid the groundwork for what it could have been, some really interesting storylines for zombie films moving forward. But I don't think anybody really tried. I know he tried to do it with the other three films, and I mean, I still appreciate them, but I don't know. There's something about Day that's very special.
Because was it Land After Day of the Dead?
It was Land After Day, yeah.
So that's 20 years later.
Yes.
Yeah. And also that was his first studio film, which he got burnt by. And then he went back to his sort of indie film roots, didn't he?
Yep. Yeah.
So, you know, I think he got it back, but they're always interesting because what I love about it more than anything else is that a guy who makes a film in 1969 sets the rules for a genre like Bram Stoker did with a book about Dracula.
I know.
It's like insane.
Who can claim his legacy is every zombie film from now on is his film was the blueprint.
Yes. Yeah.
The original three films, like, they kickstarted an entire genre that keeps going to this day. It's brilliant. So.
Right. Well, shifting tone very into a different world now.
Big shift. Yes.
A big shift. The next 5 minutes, we're going to talk about Hedwig and the Angry Inch from 2001, written and directed by John Cameron Mitchell. Tell us what this impact is, how you saw it.
Well, I'll tell you this. I saw it firsthand because I was on set for the entire shoot.
Okay, wowza.
So when I was, oh boy, this was 2000 when they shot it. Yeah, so I would have been 13. This shot in Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
Okay.
And my mom worked on the film. She was a part of the locations department. And she was working on film for years. And this was at a point, it's funny because now working in film, I'm like, you'd never get away with this. But she would just bring me to set because she knew I loved film. So Hedwig was one of those shows where she brought me to set. And I ended up, I would help out. I would just be like this non-union young volunteer on these sets, either helping her or helping other departments. In the case of Hedwig and the Angry Inch, I ended up working alongside the craft department. I worked in the
So you weren't just sat in the corner with a Game Boy.
I actually worked. I was making meals, putting stuff together. I was helping my mom with the locations department. I was on for probably 90% of that shoot. And that was one of the best summers I've ever had. And especially as somebody, you know, who loved film, was obsessed with filmmaking, specifically genre films at that age. But to go onto a set like that at that age, summer 2000, Toronto, Ontario, like, that was a life-changing experience in the sense of just seeing, oh, this is a real film. Like, watch how this is being made and the theatricality of what John was doing with his story. And also at the time, like, it's funny to see how it's become such a thing now, Hedwig. Like, it's, you know, it became a Broadway play. It's a well-respected, it's gone Criterion, for God's sakes. But back then, it was this little tiny independent film being shot in Toronto that nobody really knew what it was. Nobody really cared. It felt like we're all part of this weird artsy independent experiment. And he shot so many different scenes that we were there for that are so wild and out there that aren't even in the movie. Like, there was this whole subplot of Andrew Martin's character having a cell phone built inside her head, like, that she controlled with her teeth. So to witness that, to witness the camera work being done, to witness, you know, being a part of these amazing sets and these costumes and these characters and just having this access to it as a kid, nobody questioned that. You know, I was around the cast all the time. I was around the crew all the time, the ADs, the DP, the director, just to have that unprecedented access to see that world in such an adult story. It's less about, I really like the movie. I do. I love it. And I love the music. But a lot of that is informed by my experience of being there that summer.
Understandably.
So when I watch the movie, it's like my own little time machine to kind of go back to that summer and be like, I was there. I experienced that. I was a part of that. You know, obviously there was a whole crew there that did way more work. They put the movie together. I added like 0.01%. effort into what I could as a 13-year-old, just providing some food, and I spun some fancy disco lights. But that changed a lot of things for me. And I remember even back then, there was a very young filmmaker on set who was we have the Directors Guild of Canada, who was a DGC trainee. And I had a script back then. I'd written like a 60-page script, which was probably god-awful. But this young man read the script for me on the set and gave me all these wonderful notes. And it ended up being Brad Peyton, who directed San Andreas and like Rampage with The Rock.
Seriously?
And produced all these TV series. So it's pretty cool. I mean, yeah, Hedwig, man, that was an experience. And I still live with that. That's why I always put it on that list, because again, just the feeling of being on set, being with those people, having that experience for the first time and seeing how a film really comes together, especially a musical, and seeing kind of the ins and outs of how they made such a small budget be this big, massive story they were trying to tell. I was invited to the very first like cast and crew screening in Toronto. It was at a post house. It was a tiny, tiny little screening house. Yeah, man, it was pretty wild. It was cool. I have a lot of fond memories of that movie. So it means a lot to me. It's very important.
I imagine. Now, what it begs the question, because obviously someone growing up in Toronto, and Toronto is a location that's used as America a lot.
Yes.
How often do you get taken out of a film the minute you recognize it's Toronto?
All the time. All the time. Because I don't think it.
It must be the bane of Toronto filmmakers to be watching a movie and go, oh, that's just around the corner from where I'm sat.
It is, because there's, especially with TV shows, you're like, oh, Toronto, oh, Toronto.
Yeah.
And the Resident Evil series is notorious for that.
Okay.
Where you just, especially the first, like, well, not the third one, but the end of the first, the second one, the fourth, and the fifth one, you're like, it's just all Toronto. That's all I see. And also, you know, Toronto, in my opinion, it doesn't really look like an American city. You know, I've been to America a lot. Well, obviously, it's right next door to us.
Mm.
And it's just a very specific vibe and look that America has that I'm like, Canada just does not capture it. I think there are some parts of Canada that have American vibes to it, but whatever. I don't think anybody else notices other than Canadians.
No, you must. It just dawned on me as you were describing it, thinking, yeah, that's kind of because I guess in the tax breaks must be better and all that kind of stuff, which is what
they are. The
temptation is and to go north.
That's why we always love, you know, that David Cronenberg's movies just embrace that they're in Toronto. Like, he doesn't like point a finger and say, hey, it's Canada. You know, it's just, oh, it's Toronto. And it is just, there's the CN Tower, you know, all these other films try and hide every possible Canadian landmark. And Kroniger's just like, no, it's Canada. So I'm guilty of it too. When we're making movies, I don't know, for some reason, I just think it's so uncool for a story to be set in Canada. And I'm a proud Canadian. There's just, you know, I don't know. There's something about that American ethos. It's almost like a fantasy or something about it that's just more appealing in a cinematic language. So.
It's like Gitane cigarettes compared to the ones you can buy in your house. It's much more exotic to be foreign.
Yes.
Well, look, we've come to the end of your three films that have impacted everything in adult life, and I'm very grateful for the stories you've shared and the memories. Is there anything you got coming up in the future that you want to point out to?
Well, I mean, it's kind of like, well, first off, thank you for having me on the show.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. The pressure to pick those three titles was incredibly intense,
mm-hmm.
because it's not like you're picking they're your favorite films, but it's almost like asking somebody to pick your top five favorite films.
Which
is nearly impossible because there's so many good films. So to pick three, I just had to more channel like a, what do they mean to me now? What do I think?
And that's kind of what I want, because I don't want to do the sort of subjective, these are the best films I've ever seen, because films are about, to me, films become a personal biography. Films become memories. And sometimes you can watch a film and only watch it once, but that memory of it is perfect. And, you know, woe betide you if you go back and rewatch it, because you completely ruin a memory that you've got of something, you know. And that's a magical thing.
That
the further you get away from something, the more it gels as a memory of your life. But actually, you can go back and watch it and completely revise your thought of that memory. But equally, you can watch a film with your grandfather, you can see your film, you can be on set with your mother, and suddenly a film is elevated to somewhere else other than just seeing a movie. So that's kind of what it's all about. So I'm grateful for what you talked about. I love the reason for Terminator. That is not what I was expecting. So that's why I love doing the podcast.
Well, there we go.
Well, it just gives me to say thank you very much for giving your time on the BritFlix podcast.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun. In terms of stuff that I'm working on, I mean, like I said, that the film that we wrote and Avi directed in April, Home Free, I'm excited about that. I'm always hesitant to say what's coming up next that I'm going to do because every time I do, it never ends up being...
No, don't. I wouldn't want you to title something that's not greenlit. No, just...
So, I mean, there's a lot of exciting things that I hope I get to make, some more than others, and we'll see. Some of which have some, in a roundabout ways, connections to the titles we talked about today. So.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.